Good morning. My name is Steve Gortmaker, and we'll get started today. There are copies of a paper we just published that talks about these results in health affairs at the back, so you can pick up a free copy of that. And welcome. I'm first going to talk for about 10 minutes just to give you an overview of the methods that we used in the Choices Project, and then we'll have our four different presentations talking about the results in a number of different areas. Can everybody hear my voice back there? Pretty clear? Great, thanks. This is a project that's been going on for about 7 years. Currently we have funding from the JPB Foundation, and here's our panel. And we're gonna end with Aviva Musk giving comments, and then we'll take questions. We're gonna walk through our results relatively quickly to give you a chance to ask questions at the end and hopefully make our session a bit interactive. And thanks for being here on the last day of the meeting in Chicago, even though it's beautiful weather outside. Here's our Choices team. It's been a great team effort, again, for about 7 years, and I won't dwell on many of these slides. Of course, all of you know that obesity is at historically high levels in the United States. We think a really important issue is that obesity slowly develops over time throughout the life course, so that in early childhood, the energy gap that's kind of driving excess weight change is only about 33 calories per day. By adolescence, because weight has accumulated, the average imbalance becomes 200 kcals a day. And then adults with a BMI, let's say, of 35 or greater, which is now 14% of the population, the energy gap is 500 kcals a day. So the implication here from our perspective is you really want to have prevention throughout the life course, beginning early in life. Of course, we also have to think about a lot of risk behaviors. And hundreds of obesity interventions have been organized and put together and even evaluated, but there's been relatively limited cost-effectiveness evaluations that combine the effects, the cost, and the population reach. So what we want to do is to take that information and ask the question, you know, where do we see the best value for money, the best value for many in the interventions? Cost-effectiveness analysis, of course, compares the relative cost and outcomes of two or more courses of action to estimate the value of public health programs or policies. We like to think of the higher cost, worst outcomes as not where we want to be. The U.S. healthcare system might be seen as the poster child here for this quadrant. Higher cost, better outcomes could be useful. It may be worth the money, but of course, we'd really like to be in this quadrant. The lower cost and better outcomes. That's what we're ideally looking for, to identify those. For our choices modeling effort, we look at estimates of effect, estimates of reach, the number of people affected, and then cost, the resources required to implement. For each of our interventions, and you'll hear your different speakers talk about this, we've developed the logic models of these interventions, and these are real interventions that have been implemented in the world in various forms. We've done systematic evidence reviews for all of our interventions. Overall, we've looked at over more than 40 interventions and reviewed more than 140,000 papers. We tend to prioritize evidence from experimental, the quasi and natural experimental studies. Again, I'm running through all this stuff very quickly so we can get to the results. We use very standard costing approaches for all these interventions. We take a modified societal perspective. We include all costs regardless of payer and does not include the intervention participants' time. Just as an aside, we found that in the big scheme of things, it's really expensive to estimate the effectiveness of interventions. If you do a randomized trial, it's a lot of money. It's pretty inexpensive to estimate the cost of interventions, because a lot of the interventions we're talking about here, a lot of the costs are just people's time. The fact that we don't do more costing is actually kind of embarrassing in public health. Just something to think about. Our choices model was developed, so we need the inputs of reach, effect, and cost. And we developed a micro-simulation model. We found this was the best way to combine evidence about the effects of intervention, their population reach, their cost, and then to project how this is going to play out over the next decade, in the same way you might project the trends in population. We used a micro-simulation model where we started out with 1 million individuals, kind of like a SimCity of the U.S. population. We used data, real data, for this micro-simulation in the individuals based on the U.S. Census, the Behavioral Risk Factor System, the NHANES data, the National Survey on Children's Health. And then we modeled trajectories over time of BMI. We based that on 5 different longitudinal national data sets. So we're looking at real trajectories of real people over time in this simulation. And then we also use national smoking and mortality data. The basic framework is we project forward what's happening currently with the growth of BMI in the United States. We simulate it forward for 10 years. And then in the intervention scenario, we have effects of the interventions. And then we simulate them forward, and then we have our effects on obesity, our effects on cost effectiveness. That's the rough framework. And this just shows you a little example of how we do some of the projections. So this is actually the weight and height predicted trajectories for the young child of our statistical programmer, Zach Ward. His daughter started out here, and these 95% uncertainty of intervals give you a sense of how we incorporate uncertainty into the model. These are the metrics we'll be focusing on. We project the number of cases of childhood obesity prevented. We talk about healthcare cost savings for every dollar invested. You can see this as a return on investment. We talk about the intervention cost per BMI unit reduction per person. You know, probably most of you know your BMI. You could ask the question, well, how much would I pay to drop my BMI, one BMI unit? $1,500? How about $5? Some of the preventive interventions cost as little as that. We talk about the annual intervention cost and the reach. Now, just to give you a contrast, in our health affairs paper here, we looked at a number of preventive interventions. And we also looked at bariatric surgery. It's talked about a lot as an effective treatment for obesity. And that's one way to deal with the epidemic, treat obesity after onset. The other is to prevent. And just to give you some results for bariatric surgery, which we evaluated via our model, we did an intervention here, which was just to rapidly increase the access to bariatric surgery among children or adolescents who have a BMI of 40 or greater. We assumed a 4-fold increase. And the thing about bariatric surgery is it does have a big effect on BMI, a mean reduction of 14.5 BMI units for those who receive the surgery. The problem is that this actually doesn't reduce obesity prevalence because these adolescents begin with an average BMI of 50. So they get back down to a BMI of 35. And then of all those eligible to receive the surgery, only about 1 in 500 receive the intervention. And it's relatively costly at $1,600 per BMI unit change. So our finding here is that bariatric surgery for those who receive it and need it can be quite effective. But in terms of making much of a difference in the obesity epidemic, it does very little. Okay, so we cannot expect to treat our way out of the obesity epidemic. Preventive strategies are critically important. Now on to our panel. And our first speaker is Kelly Blondin. And I have to call up my, there we go. I mean, I know Kelly, but she just moved. And she's a nutrition policy analyst at the UC Nutrition Policy Institute. Her interests lie in nutrition policy, specifically in using rigorous, collaborative, and interdisciplinary methodology to inform and promote evidence-based policies and systems-level change. So, Kelly.
Other questions? Yes.
Maybe each of us could say one thing.
Can you say it loud?
Yeah, we can.
Yeah, say it loud.
I think one thing that I was struck by with the early child care is that the NAPSAC model, and you'll probably talk about this more, but is evidence-based intervention that can be done to improve child care, and the focus on spending money to prevent child obesity for the youngest children doesn't save health care costs, and so I think that's an area where we should focus investing revenue from these tax policies is on really achieving that zero to five goal of getting kids to buy at a healthy weight with healthy behaviors. And so I think any changes that focus on improving early child care, given that the school environments have already been improved so much. And so I think that my mind is the money generating.
Kelly?
Changes in schools around smart snacks and marketing and school environments really tend to happen, at least in Maine, more when there's someone there. I'm championing that those changes in schools and implementing the policies that we already have in place. So I would say school health coordinators funding those and making sure there's someone in the schools to do that.
And I'll just say, why don't we let Berkeley then show us the next frontier of exciting work. You guys figure it out.
Sir, you got one?
Politically, and this is probably not passing early, but if you could fund a full-time employee of the first major fast food restaurant that would take the money from Berkeley and reduce it for reformulation efforts.
That's a really interesting idea.
Yeah. You may not get the results, but you would definitely get the
You could put out the RFA, right?
That's a good idea.
That's an excellent idea. Very creative. Do you have any health communicators in the audience that have a suggestion? licensing fee.
Yeah. So I think some kind of licensing fees for operating a business are different than a tax.
Yeah, I think which state are you from? Because all states have these fees that they charge for, like, fishing gear and stuff like that, and, you know, fishing, hunting,
stuff.
Right, but in Illinois, the fee has to cover enforcement. So you can't make any revenue from it. So our tobacco licensing, so not all states, even though they have fees, can use the money for anything other than enforcement fees.
Enforcement of, like, food? Food settings or something.
I just wanted to say that in California, the advocates thought that even in the places where the tax would not pass, that simply using the word tax and having it discussed in the media enough that sugary beverages should be taxed brings up the point that they're bad and could actually help raise awareness about the use of the subject. So don't give up on the word tax, especially if you're already mad anyway.
And tying it to something that we were talking about last night at dinner that's mentioned in the article is that the money that you use to advertise a food is tax deductible for that corporation. So maybe tying the tax on sugar sweetened beverages to the removal of the tax write-off for advertisements, you know, might be a way to make it tax neutral.
And that way you get to say tax three times.
Final question, and then we'll close it up. I'm sure there are probably some people who want to come up and have some individual conversations. Yes?
I just want to, Karen Smith from Human Services, and I would have to say this has been an awesome conference, first time ever for me. But this session was especially effective for me because I am a teacher with primarily a fiscal background, and bringing that connection between cost effectiveness, not only in terms of the monetary gain, but also the impact on programming, there's still a disconnect out there. And so I am just so excited that this one could even get done. It's like, wow, this is refreshing. So I applaud you, and I am very excited to have more conversations.
I think that's a great place for the last word, so let's thank our panelists.